Good morning and thank you for joining us. Welcome to Smart Talk, which is a joint project between the University of Arizona's College of Social and Behavioral Sciences and the College of Education. We're here every Saturday on KVOI, and today I'm your host, Robin Hiller. Thank you for tuning in. So I'm very excited about today's guest. Arizona Superintendent of Public Instruction, Kathy Hoffman, is here to talk about her goals for Arizona education, what's going on with current policies, and some of the things that have happened in the past 2 weeks, which has been very exciting. And she is an educator, a speech pathologist, not that those are separate, that is, and received her master's from the University of Arizona College of Education, and began, not only did you go to college here, but you began your teaching career here?
I did. I started my career as a preschool teacher out in East Tucson.
Oh, wow. So preschool for a district or?
Nope. It was actually a charter school, the Tucson Country Day School.
Oh, great. Okay. And in 2018, you won, November 2018, you won the race in what has been called the year of educators running across the country. It was pretty astounding and exciting. Even in Arizona, we saw that.
Yes, I would say it was a big win for educators and education with my win, and but also with all the other wins that we had in 2018.
Mm-hmm. And so what, you were working as a speech pathologist when you decided to run, and what was the impetus for you running?
It definitely was not something I could have predicted. I was extremely happy in my career working as a speech pathologist for the public schools. I had worked both in the Vail School District and then in the Peoria School District up in Phoenix. And for me, the tipping point was when I watched the confirmation hearing for Betsy DeVos. And I remember that moment so vividly as I heard her, and she was talking, you know, clearly had never been and never worked in a school, didn't have a grasp of classroom issues and the implications of policies in the classroom. And that's when I realized that we need more educators running for office. And I decided to step up, and I started my campaign immediately in early 2016 and started sharing my stories from the classroom of my students and my colleagues of what it was like and the impact of legislation in our classrooms, and the rest is history.
And you wrote up a phenomenal campaign. I mean, I remember reading that you went to bed that night and thought that you were not going to win. And then in the morning, the gap had narrowed and then narrowed and then narrowed. About how long did it take for them to realize how long you'd won? A week or?
It was about a week. So uh-huh. Yeah, when I went to bed on election night, I was down by about 10,000 votes. And I remember feeling a bit discouraged, but every single day, like you said, the gap closed, and we just kept inching ahead and ahead, and until finally they announced and made it official.
It's pretty amazing. So what was your, now that you're in office, can you explain what the Superintendent of Public Instruction does? Because it's interesting, because you are an elected official, but there's also another body that you work with that is an appointed group of people. Can you explain how that works? And
yeah, so first thing I'll say about being superintendent is I've been in some ways very pleasantly surprised by the job, because, and part of that is because on the campaign trail, many people said to me, why do you even want that job? It's just an administrative job, and there's no power in being superintendent, because the legislature and the governor are really the one that control the budget and mm-hmm. a lot of those policies. So luckily, I didn't let that deter me. And so now that I'm in the position, I've really been able to, in some ways, reimagine and redefine what the role of superintendent really should be. And I think we have had people in that position that have viewed it as more just administrative, but really to me the role has always been someone who ought to be the advocate for our schools, for our students, for our teachers. And so that's how I view the role, is every single day, how can I advocate for public education in Arizona? And so what that looks like on a day-to-day basis is that I am often meeting with legislators or other policy experts in the field. I do serve on the Board of Education, as well as the State Charter School Board, as well as the Board of Regents. So I have a very unique role in that I'm the only one who's appointed to all three of those major boards that also drive education policy in Arizona. And so I can help bridge between those different boards, as well as the Department of Education. Of course, I also oversee the entire Department of Education, which here in Arizona was actually quite large. We have almost 600 people that work in the Department of Education, with many different types of departments, mm-hmm. including special education to adult education, early education, certification. We have a lot of different departments, a lot of experts in the that work in our department. I've been very impressed by the high quality of staff that work in the department with us. And then I've put a lot of my focus and of my time in office so far working on policy, and also working on improving communication out to the field, being very transparent with all the work that we're doing. So every day looks a little different. I love going out and visiting schools and continuing to stay connected and learning about the issues and how can I be a support to our schools. But I would say every single day is a little bit different.
It has been, I follow you on Twitter, and it has been great to see all those images of you out in the schools and visiting schools. It's really, if anyone wants to check that out, your Twitter handle is?
It's SUPT_Hoffman.
Yeah, mm-hmm. It is great to see those, because I often think that there's a disconnect between the legislature, even, and the governor, and all these policymakers, and what is actually going on in our classrooms, because we could use some help.
Definitely. And I've made it a priority to make sure that I'm getting around the state too, and not just going to schools. I live in Phoenix, and I don't just go to Phoenix schools. I mm-hmm. just in the past 3 months, I've already been to over 20 schools in 6 different counties. And by the end of April, I will have been to 8 of our 15 counties. I'm going up to Navajo and Apache counties next week.
Oh, great. Mm-hmm. That's wonderful.
Very excited.
Have you learned anything that you were unaware of by going? I mean, because you were in the classroom or at a school for many years.
I have learned so much. And so the issues that I saw in the classroom do translate to other schools and districts as well. But something I've become much more aware of since I started my campaign is the issue of housing for teachers. And in many places around the state, including Patagonia, Prescott Valley, as well as on Native American reservations, I've heard a lot of concern about sometimes that there is no housing. So for example, for the teachers that work in Sells, Arizona, close to the border, a lot of times they live in Tucson and commute an hour and a half each way.
Every day, yes.
Because they just don't have the housing options. Whereas in places like Patagonia, maybe they have housing, but it's not affordable to teachers. So there's different types of issues surrounding housing, but that wasn't something that I was really aware of until I started traveling and asking teachers about what obstacles they were facing. And that directly ties into their ability to stay a teacher and continue to work in the classroom is whether or not they can find or afford housing.
So is it like in places like Patagonia and maybe Sedona, is it that there's no affordable housing, or is it that the teachers do not make enough to pay for the housing, that the housing is just priced out of every middle class family?
It's probably a combination, mm-hmm. that they're on a teacher's salary alone, they can't afford the housing, so they're priced out. But I would imagine that there could be other professions that are in the same boat that are also feeling that there's a lack of housing if you're not making enough money. But I think that I've talked with many teachers who have said that either they have a partner that has a higher income that can help them afford things like housing, or if they don't, especially if it's a married couple that's two teachers, then they really struggle to make ends meet. And that's, so when I was in Prescott, I met, she was a former teacher of the year for the Prescott area. And she said she's working a second job to make ends meet. And that's just hard. That's devastating if your real passion is to be in the classroom and be a teacher, but that you can't pay your bills by doing what you love to do, such that you have to take on another job in the evenings or on the weekends, and then that's less time with your family. Then I think that's part of why there's still a lot of frustration around the need for additional funding in our public schools.
Yes, it is very hard because people have a fantasy that teachers get off at 3 o'clock in the afternoon and they have weekends off and then they have all the great holidays and they're off for the summer and can just put their feet up. But most of the teachers I know, I remember years ago, my sister-in-law was telling me, she goes, I can't figure out why I'm so relaxed this summer. She goes, I just feel really relaxed. And then she said, she goes, you know what it is she's a teacher of the deaf, and she goes, I've been teaching for 12 years, and she goes, and I finally have enough materials to start the school year with. Usually I spend her entire summers getting materials ready, and she goes, I now have a body of materials that I can, you know, go into the classroom and start. And that was a shocker.
And that speaks to actually the reason why it's important for us to, as much as possible, keep our standards and our state testing consistent in a way that, that teachers can plan ahead. And also, whenever we have a major overhaul of something like the standards, then teachers feel like they have to start over and completely re-examine all the materials they've created before to make sure that they're aligned to the standard. So that's something that we talk a lot about in the department is, of course, so we recently just updated our science standards and social studies standards as well as our computer science standards. But we've been really mindful of, well, how can we make sure that we're not changing the standards too frequently, because we want them to be rigorous. We want to have high quality standards, but I'm very in tune with the fact that it's how challenging it is for teachers to make materials and for also the districts to provide professional development to make sure that the teachers feel ready to teach to those standards.
And one of the things I've heard from teachers is when the standards do change, the first chunk of time before school starts, instead of setting up their classrooms, they're actually in professional development, getting ready to do the new standards.
Exactly.
So one of the things I wanted to ask you is, and I will ask you after, I want to talk to you about special ed funding, but we're going to go for break. If you have a question, give us a call at 520-790-2040. I'm speaking with Superintendent Kathy Hoffman this morning. And if you have any comments, give us a call. Thanks. Hi, we're back. You're listening to Smart Talk. I'm your host, Robin Hiller, and we are joined today by Kathy Hoffman. But before I get to Kathy, I just want to do a shout out to Jim Talmadge, who is a teacher in Tucson, who is a teacher at the school my children went to. And this was his 50th year this year. He started out as a student teacher there. And after he retired, he remained as the chess teacher and was an amazing math teacher, taught math cross country. His students went on to become the best math students wherever they went. And it was wonderful to see all these parents and students. The students from his first class came to see him on this 50th anniversary. Anyway, that's a shout out to Mr. T. Thank you for your years of service. Okay, now we're back to Superintendent Hoffman. So one of the things we were talking about during the break is that there has been an increase of special needs kids in schools and ADHD kids and that. But the funding doesn't seem to be increasing. And I know part of the problem is the feds, and maybe you could explain that, how they committed to 40% and they're only giving 17%. But anyway, let's start with that. Why is there such an increase in special ed funding?
Why do we need an increase? So I've traveled the state, that has been a reoccurring request from district leaders that their special education programs are severely underfunded. And that's something that I witnessed myself as someone who worked in special education in Arizona. So the services needed for kids to be successful, for our kids with disabilities, are expensive. And we have to face that fact. It is very expensive. So for example, if you have a child with multiple disabilities, that I can think of one student I had who was wheelchair bound. She had a vision impairment. She had speech and language needs. So she was receiving services in the school from everyone in special education. So she's getting speech therapy, occupational therapy, physical therapy, as well as the vision instructor coming in to make sure that she could see the classroom materials because she just needed extra technology to access that. She had a paraprofessional that was with her day in, day out, because as she was wheelchair bound, she needed help getting around the campus and had to have someone with her at all times for that mobility piece. And so, yes, to educate her is very expensive, and we have to keep the pay of those specialists competitive because we do have a shortage of special education teachers as well as even speech pathologists in the district, because if we don't keep their salary, it's somewhat competitive with the private sector, then people are inclined to go work for private practice where, for example, you can see one child at a time instead of feeling like you have a high caseload of students mm-hmm. to work with, and make easily $10,000, $20,000 more. So another good example I heard recently was from the someone in the Tucson Unified School District that they're struggling to have enough sign language interpreters. So if you have a student who is deaf or hard of hearing and they need a sign language interpreter, then right now it's a challenge because the sign language interpreters can make double what they can in the schools by working in the courts. So we're having this type of competition between the public schools and the private sector of competitive pay. And when you don't have the special education funding, which we have not fully funded, our state has not funded it, the federal government has not fully funded special education, then districts have to pull from other parts of their budget to in order to make sure they're providing the quality services that the children need and require. And that's been a real struggle for districts to fully provide the services for those students. And then, of course, if they don't provide the level of service that a child needs, you are, first of all, putting their life at risk if they don't have the services they need. For example, if they don't have that paraprofessional making sure that they can safely get around campus or safely take medication and those types of things. And so that's a huge concern. But secondly, if you're not providing the services, then the family has every right to take the school in the district to court and demand that their child's special education services are fully provided. So it's a liability for the districts as well.
This is kind of a basic question, but can you explain occupational therapy? Because sometimes when parents who don't have a kid who is using that service, they're going, why are you giving occupational therapy to a fourth grader? You know, what is going on? So if you could explain that, I think it would be helpful.
I can give a general description since I'm not an occupational therapist. I can speak to my experiences in working with them. But what it typically looks like in the school setting is they do an evaluation of their more fine motor skills. So if a child is having difficulty with writing or with cutting due to deficits in their fine motor skills, so if they have any kind of weakness or just low muscle tone, then they may need that type of service to help them with that. But I know their job extends beyond that. I've seen them, for example, for kids with autism, they often have sensory needs, and the occupational therapist is usually a good resource to ask them if they can help provide different types of strategies to help them with their sensory needs as well.
In this morning's Arizona Republic online page, there was this article, and it said that ADHD is up 30%. And they gave these numbers that in preschool, it's up 1%. In elementary, it's up 7.4%. And in middle school, it's up 9%. And it reminded me of Pasi Sahlberg when he was talking about what happened in Finland. And that is that there's no, when in the early years, when they refer a child, any teacher can refer a child. They can just say, I think this kid needs help, and the kid gets services. We have a different system here where it sometimes takes a year or so for a teacher to get the services that a kid might need, and even then they might not get it. But he said that they have a huge group of kids getting who are diagnosed with learning disabilities in K through 3. And then it drops off, whereas we're seeing a bigger increase in the middle schools and a smaller one and in the early years, so that what happens is our kids stay in the system longer with have greater needs. And in Finland, they seem to be, after 3 or 4 years, they don't need the they don't need the special services anymore. Have you ever seen that? Or
that? Yeah, that is an interesting point. And I think one thing I've heard or noticed in the schools as far as the ADHD diagnoses is that our schools oftentimes don't give their don't have as much recess time as they once did, or there could be other factors to why we're seeing more ADHD types behaviors in the schools. And I think it's a really multifaceted issue and kind of a cultural issue that we are seeing such high rates of ADHD here in the States, but not so much in other countries. I think that's a really interesting phenomenon to look at, is why is there such a huge discrepancy between here and other countries? And I know that the evaluation process is typically very rigorous. As you said, it can take up to, hopefully doesn't always take a year, but it can take months to come to that diagnosis. And oftentimes it can come from a doctor as well. But I think we just need to be very considerate about and very cautious in medicating our young kids at such a young age. And I think we haven't yet really seen what are the long-term effects of our kids. And of course, I'm not a doctor, but I think it's just something we should all be thinking critically about, is why are we seeing this increase, and what can we do? What strategies can we put into place to help kids be successful in school? And are we giving them enough movement time, or whether that be recess or different physical activities, or even in Arizona, we've seen such a decrease in extracurriculars due to lack of funding. So what about having more time for music and art and those best parts of our school system that we've also seen major cuts to over the years? So I think we need to look at the issue holistically.
You mentioned recess, and can you talk a little more about what has happened with recess? Because it doesn't seem like there's a lot anymore.
There hasn't been, and there was a new law passed last year that is, I can't remember the exact minutes, but there is a new law as of about a year ago that's mandating more recess time in the schools, and hopefully that is being put into practice in our school. So I know it's something that people are aware of and advocating for, but I think it needs to be throughout their whole day as well.
So my kids went to a school district that didn't have music and art for many years, the entire time they were growing up. And now I see that even within a district, there's such a discrepancy between schools that can afford music and art because they can raise tax credit money, and schools that have no music and art because they cannot afford it. And that's not like two separate districts. That's within one district. Can you talk about the importance of music? Is it important to have music and art? And A, and B, how can we get it if it is?
It is very important for our students to have music and art. We know that's brain development right there, that when we're thinking about it in a sense of just neurological development, that we want both sides of the brain to basically have that type of exercise. And we know that if you are studying and practicing music, it helps you in math, and it can help you with learn a foreign language. And there's all these benefits to having that type of both music and art. It's also known to be very therapeutic. So we in Arizona, sadly, have many, many students that have experienced various types of trauma, whether that be that we have some students who have been refugees previously to coming to Arizona, or as they have come to Arizona as refugees. And so that's one situation. And sadly, other kids who are in the foster care system or other types of trauma that they've gone through. And we know that music and art can be very therapeutic for them. So that's another benefit and reason why we should make it a priority. And I know, again, it kind of all comes full circle, that if we're not fully funding our schools, our schools don't have the funding they need to maintain their facilities or to have special education services or have competitive pay for educators, it's the first thing that goes is the music and arts and those types of programs that are are deemed to be less necessary. So we've kind of cut our schools down to the bare bones of what do they have to provide, and then the things that are less mandatory fall to the wayside until there's a budget for it. So that's why it's critical to make sure that we fully fund our schools and make sure that all of these programs have the funding they need.
Okay, we have to take a break right now, but I'd like to talk, when we get back, you mentioned funding. I'd like to talk about funding and ELL and a few other things. So we will be right back. If you have any questions, give us a call at 520-790-2040. Thanks. Hi, we're back. You're listening to Smart Talk, and we are here with Superintendent of Public Instruction, Kathy Hoffman. And one of the things we wanted to talk about is some of the changes that have just happened in the past month up in Phoenix, up in at the legislature. So let's start with the ELL changes. And that's something you talked about during your campaign. And when I say ELL, I mean English language learners.
Yeah.
And so it's something that I remember you talking about. And can you talk about what it has been and what the changes are and what you think it should look like now?
Yeah, well, first, let me give my background too of why this was something I was so passionate about and made it a huge priority, both on the campaign trail and still to this day. So I had the privilege growing up of attending a Japanese immersion program from kindergarten through eighth grade. So I had half the day in Japanese and half the day in English. And as a result, I speak Japanese. And then in college, went on to learn Spanish. And so now I'm trilingual. And I can personally speak to all the numerous benefits to being multilingual, and both professionally, academically, culturally, socially. There's so many benefits, and all the research points to all the benefits of multilingual people. And so that's why I came at this issue very passionately. And also when I was at U of A, I did research in the area of the speech and language development of bilingual kids. So I also have a research background in this area. And so what I saw happening in our schools was because of the prior laws that we just changed, but before these new changes, what was happening was the state was mandating that our English language learning students, or ELL students, that they be separated out into a four-hour block of English-only instruction. And so at the high school level, what this often looked like was very detrimental to their success, because if you're a high school student who has to be in a four-hour English-only class, that means you don't have time in your day or in your schedule for other required classes or even electives. They're completely missing out on electives because it was over half of their day in this English class. And so what was happening is they have not been graduating high school. That our high school graduation rate for our ELL students in Arizona has been 18%. And
that's
the lowest in the country. And this is unacceptable. And that's something I have said repeatedly, is that it's completely unacceptable that less than one in five of our ELL students are graduating high school, when we know they have every ability to be successful, just as any other student is. And we need to be doing everything we can to support them. So what we did legislatively to change this is they changed the law to give more flexibility to schools. So it's now required to be 2 hours, but there's more. They wrote in more flexibility into the law as well. So it doesn't have to be a 2 hour block. It could be more. You could have different types of instruction models. And so our department has been working really actively with our with different English language instructors and districts across the state to make sure that they understand that there's what the different types of models might look like. And we're also giving them time to transition into this new model, because this is a big change for districts. But I think it's going to be a very positive change. And I'm hopeful that we are going to see a drastic increase in our high school graduation rate. Some of the students were dropping out of high school because they just were not feeling successful in school. They were missing out on all those other classes with their peers. So some of them were many of them were just dropping out. And so I'm really hoping that this helps address this issue. And we're also, as the department, not, don't work at the district anymore, as a department, we're also rolling out new EL standards to also help address this, our low performance in this area.
Okay, we have a call from Charles, who's on the phone. Hello, Charles.
Hi. You know, Robin, this is great because you're really bringing a lot of light to education. Ms. Hoffman, I hear the passion, and it's really cool to have somebody that speaks three languages
Thank
in
you.
A position of authority, because I think every language, my grandfather used to say, opens another window to the world.
I completely agree.
Yeah. So my thought is, in terms of the housing circumstance for teachers who would like to be in the profession, but maybe the area they're in is a little pricier than their paycheck is, or something like it. In those areas, like in the Sedona area, what if you could convince the legislature to do a one-for-one tax break for a resort that would allow one room for a teacher to live in? They could certainly afford it, and they could also get a tax break for it, and also get some nice publicity. And like, say, at Los Abrigados in Sedona, it's a beautiful place, and let a teacher live in one of their units. It would solve a bunch of problems, and it wouldn't directly cost the education system anything, because you wouldn't have to pay the teacher more. The resort would be giving them the room basically on a semi-permanent basis. And in places where there aren't resorts, like out in Ajo, there is, I heard on Zach Yenser's program, excellent program, Creative Cities, the people that have the stack house, and they're taking shipping containers and making them into 320 square foot tiny homes. And what about considering purchasing some of those units, or even putting up a stack house out in Ajo? Let the school district own it. It doesn't cost much money. They're about $45,000 a unit. And maybe you could even get a campaign to get sponsorship of it, where a business would sponsor it. Again, not cost the department very much. You'd have a place for the teachers to live. And also, those tiny houses use a minute amount of energy. You'd be actually being environmentally conscious. You'd be, to quote Kermit, you'd be being green.
Yeah, I love those ideas. I just took down some notes so I remember them. And the Vail School District, they are working to build tiny houses for teachers at a very affordable rate. And so I'd love to see more of that. And something that's really cool about that, too, is that they include their high school students in the carpentry program, who are doing career and technical education carpentry programs to help build the houses, and then they have the tiny houses for teachers. So I definitely agree with you. We need to start thinking creatively about how to solve this issue. And of course, our teachers need competitive pay as well. That's something else we need to address. But in the meantime, like, I really like the idea of just providing more options for our teachers.
Well, living costs are a chunk of your budget. And if you didn't have to pay rent or mortgage, your salary would be far much more your salary. But you just gave me another idea, and that is for, like, the shop students and the people who are involved in building programs, there's another thing you could do. They could build brigs for misbehaving students.
Build what? Brigs?
A brig. A jail.
A jail.
Yeah, at the school, you know, like a little confinement room, you know, a penalty room for misbehaving students. Not only could you decrease costs, you could really affect behavioral change.
I'd rather have them build tiny houses. Another thing I've heard about, and I'm actually going to be making a visit out there, is in Miami, Arizona. They are taking an old elementary school that is no longer in use, and they are turning it into apartments for teachers. And so I'm going to go check that out in the next couple weeks.
They've done that in Portland, Oregon.
Yep, exactly. So yes. I'm very curious to see how that looks, too.
Well, thank you so much for calling, Charles.
Thanks. Have a nice day. Thanks for listening.
Thank you.
So I'm of two minds. I'm going to be devil's advocate on this, because I think we do. I mean, Charles had some very creative ideas, but it's just like when they want to give tax credits to teachers for paying for their supplies and stuff. I always think, why don't we just increase the funding so you can provide teachers with what they need rather than. And so there's a part of me that thinks, this might be a short-term goal, but what about when teachers want to start families and all that kind of thing? Wouldn't it be better if they had real salaries? Although I guess they could save the money while they're living in the resort.
Right. I'm not a huge fan of any tax credits either. I would definitely be looking for more sustainable solutions. Like, I liked the idea of using the shipping containers because that is a way to recycle, uh-huh. and it provides more options. So it shouldn't be a long-term solution, but especially for young teachers who are looking for an apartment or who just, I know many of my friends who are in their 20s and even early 30s, that they're not ready to settle down and buy a house yet. They are looking for something more short-term. So for them, I think having options like the tiny houses and or apartments I do also like the idea of districts owning housing, so they can basically subsidize the housing for teachers and give them a lower cost way to live. But I agree with you that if it comes down to where should the money go, I would say put it in the teacher's pocket.
There is a complex here on the west side where they've taken shipping containers and made it into this shopping restaurant thing. And at first when I heard about it, I thought, won't it be dark in there, you know? But they're really beautiful, what they've done. I have to say, it's out near the Mercado. And if teachers could live there, they might be very happy. But still, tiny.
Yes. And so, it's not for everyone, but some people love it. And but it's definitely not for everyone.
So I wanted to ask you, we have to take a break in a few minutes, but I wanted to ask you about class size in K-3. What are the chances of us getting that here? Reducing class size in K-3, and what are some of the benefits?
Well, that class size is a huge concern for teachers because, as we know, with every additional body in a classroom, it increases the workload of our teachers, and our students deserve to have the attention they need every single day from their teacher. But where I see class size issues as directly correlated to the teacher pay issues, the teacher shortage issues, and so ultimately it is a funding issue. Because we can't, with the teacher shortage, which is still one of my biggest concerns, until we address that, we just don't have the teachers to reduce the classroom size. And it's not good enough to just have a body. Like, we already have a significant number of long-term substitute teachers or emergency certified teachers. And to be a long-term sub, I'm very grateful for having them in the classroom, but at the same time, that the requirement is that you only need your high school degree to have a substitute certificate in Arizona. So we really want to raise the bar.
I didn't know that.
And have more long-term. So we really need to look at teacher recruitment and retention as a priority, and that's something that we are working on. Another area that I'm working on in addition to housing is looking at the cost of healthcare on teachers. We were doing research to see how much are teachers paying towards their health insurance. And we're going to start, once we have that data collected, we're going to do some modeling to see if we can, as a state, provide some other options. Because I've heard from teachers that the cost of health insurance can drain their paychecks as well. And that's something we haven't really talked about.
Well, one of the things they found in the Tennessee Star study, which was the biggest study on class size reduction, they randomly assigned 8,000 students a year to different size classrooms. And one of the classrooms, and this is awful because teachers would probably love this size classroom, was 25. And the other was 22 to 25 and above with an aide. And then there were 18 and under. And what originally the researchers thought is that 22 to 25 with an aide was going to be the biggest gains for the students. And what they found is that wasn't the case, that the aide was, it was great for the teacher and took a workload off her or him. But in terms of academic gains for the students, it did not do as much as having, and these were K-3 students, having 18 and under, which were kind of a far away from that.
Yes.
But now that they've looked at these students for 35 years, it's amazing to see that they have retained those. They are still outperforming their peers who are in the larger classrooms. And I believe I'm getting the sign to take a small break. We'll be back in just a minute. Thanks. Hi there. We're back. You're listening to Smart Talk. I'm your host, Robin Hiller, and I'm speaking with Superintendent of Public Instruction, Kathy Hoffman. That is such a great title.
Thank you.
I wanted to ask you about the changes that had just happened this week in LGBTQ legislation that we'd had this policy, and if you could explain the policy and how it's changed dramatically this week.
So this was a historic win for equality in Arizona, and it is such my privilege to have helped make this possible.
And this is also something that you talked about during the campaign, the importance of this.
It is. And during the campaign, it was clear to me that there wasn't a lot of understanding around this law. As I went around and talked to people and explained to them what the law said, I could just see that people were shocked that we had such a law on the books in here in Arizona, because the language in itself was so offensive. So what it previously said, until we repealed it this past week, but the law that is sometimes has been referred to as the No Promo Homo law, it was very specific to the law was written under how teachers teach about HIV and AIDS in curriculum in the health classes. So it was very specific to that class. But the law said, and I will quote, it said, "You may not promote a homosexual lifestyle." That's what the law said. Those are not my words. And those words in itself are incredibly offensive to essentially be saying that there is a right and a wrong type of relationship. And it was very stigmatizing to our students and families in the LGBTQ community. And they have made this a priority for years to have this law repealed because it was so incredibly offensive. And so the effects of this law too, I have to say, were that students and the families in the LGBTQ community felt less welcome and felt less safe. And teachers felt that they couldn't talk about LGBTQ issues because of this law, even though it was only written to apply to HIV and AIDS curriculum. And also, on another note, it's not providing our students with medically accurate or science-based information about HIV and AIDS, which is deadly, and we need to be making sure we're doing everything we can to be preventative on that front. So what happened was, I advocated to repeal the law during my campaign, and then I mentioned it again in my State of Education speech that this was
beginning of February.
Yep, I made it again, restated that as a priority, a legislative priority, and then a lawsuit was filed by Equality Arizona, which is an LGBTQ advocacy group that named me and the Board of Education, saying that this law was unconstitutional and discriminatory, which I agree with. It was the first time one of the only times I'll say that I was happy to be sued because I agreed with them that this law needed to be repealed. So then, so of course I made the statement that I would not be defending the law.
Right.
And then it got pushed further when the attorney general said he would also not be defending the law. That was a huge win to have both of our agencies not defending the law. So then it got, then the legislature decided to take action on it. And I'm very grateful for the bipartisan support on this. So Representative
TJ
Shoup, he said that he took the lead and the charge on this, and he got the votes. And I am incredibly proud of that bipartisan effort. And just, it happened like a flash, like just within a couple of days that the House voted, the Senate voted, and the governor signed it all within just a couple of days.
Right.
And it happened so quickly that we're pretty taken aback by how quickly that it got passed. And I am just so proud of our legislature for getting it done and getting it done quickly, and the governor supporting that. And it's just amazing what we can do when we all come together on an issue that was so clearly discriminating against our LGBTQ students.
And it also shows what a different time we're living in, that this would happen so quickly, that people that we consider would never have supported this maybe 5 or 10 years ago, this sign on. I mean, it was
historic.
It is historic. It is pretty wonderful. And also, what are some of the things that this doesn't have necessarily to do for the health classes, which was disturbing in that they couldn't tell kids, they weren't allowed to say what you can do to protect yourself during sex. And this is in an HIV program, which is frightening. But what are some of the things outside of the health class that LGBTQ kids face in schools?
Well, I have talked with many students. So for example, I met some students that told me that they did not feel safe transitioning from class to class because of the amount of bullying and harassment that they received for who they were, for being part of the LGBTQ community, that they felt scared. And we know that, very sadly, that they experience a higher rate of suicide and mental health issues, even homelessness. If sometimes families aren't accepting of their children for being part of the LGBTQ community, which is why it's so critically important that our schools are a safe place where the children feel safe and welcome, because sometimes that's the only place they can have that security if their families are not accepting. And I have met several homeless youth who are in the LGBTQ community, and that's something that is highly disturbing and alarming to me, as well as making sure that they're safe and taken care of.
So you've been in office for a very short time. You just took office in January, and some of the things you talked about on the campaign that were your goals have actually happened, which is pretty astounding, and we applaud that. What's next for you? What are you thinking of? This is where, you know, this office and this position, a lot of people who've had this position have not had your education background. You are actually the first Democrat since 1995 with C. Diane Bishop. You're also, you know, a breaker in terms of age. She's very ancient. No, she's very, very, the youngest person. This is what it said on one of the news stations. You were the youngest person.
The youngest woman elected a statewide office in the country.
Yes, which is pretty impressive. So you have this incredible bully pulpit and also, you know, power to do. What are your next things you want to work on?
Well, I have to say we're working on a lot. I keep very busy and been multitasking on that. But so some of the big things I would say, one, I'm still advocating to repeal the English-only law, which prohibits our teachers from speaking to students in any other language besides English, which, if you can just imagine being in Nogales, where your teachers are bilingual, the students are bilingual, and again, we know all the benefits of being bilingual, yet we're prohibiting our teachers from even explaining a concept in Spanish is just ridiculous. So that's one thing that we're going to continue to fight against. The teacher shortage is also one of my...
And the ELL the 4-hour did not impact that.
I would say that's step one, was okay. Reducing the 4-hour blocks. But no, we still have the English-only law. It's actually... It would actually have to be referred to the ballot because it was a voter initiative, I think roughly 20 years ago. And so we still have work to do there. And there's a lot of misunderstanding around that as well. But I think Arizona's ready to support bilingual programs and make, mm-hmm. And support our students being multilingual as well. But the teacher shortage, I'm very concerned with having high quality instruction in the classroom. And so, for example, we have a shortage of physics teachers, a shortage of calculus teachers, and our students need to have high quality STEM coursework in the K-12 grades, or else how are they going to go on to be successful in college to become scientists or engineers or doctors if we're not even providing them with the foundational math and science curriculum in the lower grades? So that's something that we're working on and very concerned with, and we're working on improving access to those classes and also supporting our teachers who are in the STEM fields to provide them with high quality professional development and training so that they can advance their careers as well.
What do you think about this idea of providing additional funding for teachers who teach in hard to find, what would it be called? Hard to find positions.
Yeah, hard to fill. I would support that. There was also a law that was providing extra funding for teachers to go if they want to return to get their master's degree. That there's also a bill that would help supplement their tuition, and I support that. Those types of
is that the Randy Freeze bill? Or is that a different one?
It was actually a Sylvia Allen bill.
Okay.
Run by physics teachers.
Oh, great. Because I think Randy's, which was for providing college at a reduced rate.
We supported that bill too.
Has gone by the wayside. Mm-hmm. So about what is our shortage right now with STEM teachers, with calculus teachers?
Well, I can say
you said math and physics.
Yeah, so I can say we only have 150 physics teachers in Arizona, and that as a result, that roughly only 20% of high school students in Arizona take physics, and the national average is 40%. So we are significantly behind the national trend for how many of our students take physics.
Okay, to put that in perspective, and we only have 1.5 minutes, we have 150 physics teachers in the state of Arizona. How many English high school teachers do we have? Do you know offhand?
Well, we have over 200 districts. Let's start there.
Okay.
That means we don't even have enough for each district to have a physics teacher.
Okay.
To put that into perspective. And we have 1.1 million students in Arizona. I guess that's not, I'm talking more about our high school students, and I don't have that number offhand. But yeah, we don't even have enough physics teacher for every district.
Every district. Okay. So we're running at a deficit to start with.
And it's especially hard hit in our rural areas that are really struggling to fill these positions.
Okay. Well, I want to thank you for coming in sharing all this with us. Is there anything you'd like to, we have about 30 seconds. Is there anything?
Please make sure you're following me on social media. I have Superintendent Hoffman on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram. That way you can see all the exciting work we're doing. I'm still going around highlighting all the achievements of our teachers and students, and want to make sure that everyone sees all the amazing work that is being done in our schools. We have there's such incredible teachers and students here, and I want to make sure we're recognizing all their hard work. So please make sure you're following along so you can catch all the updates from our Department of Education.
Okay, well, we are going to, I want to thank you for coming. We'll be here next week. But also, I want to tell you that I've talked to several of the classes you visited, and the teachers are so moved, as are the students that you are there visiting. So thank you, and good luck fixing our schools so that they're all better by the next 6 months. We really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thanks. Bye.